David Grush, Robert Jacobs, David Fravor, Robert Salas, Michael Herrera, all UFO whistleblowers who have sworn their testimony before Congress, testified to Arrow, or signed legal affidavits to swear in their statements. Phil Schneider, Clifford Stone, Don Phillips, Mr. Dennis, all UFO whistleblowers with astounding claims persisting throughout the decades, but with no real legal testimony or evidence to back them up. UFO whistleblowers have appeared throughout the decades highlighting stories of incredible encounters, reverse engineering, crash retrievals, sinister USG elements hiding the UAP estimate. Whether these claims come with verifiable evidence, affidavits, sworn testimonies before Congress, or they reach our ears as little more than stories from a public or anonymous source, all UFO whistleblower testimonies deserve to be analyzed with a critical lens. Who knows what whistleblowers with sobering and real testimonies have been overlooked or buried in the annals of UFO lore? Who knows what whistleblowers may give us a peek behind the veil to get a glimpse at the shadowy program that has likely been operating since at least 1947? Hey guys, it's UAP Gerb, and join me today as I begin part 2 of my series studying UFO whistleblowers throughout history. This series will bring to light lesser-known whistleblowers I find worthy of discussing and studying. We will investigate the person making the claims and analyze the context of their claims to see if we can start making heads or tails of the astonishing and perplexing stories of first-hand encounters with UAP. Harland F. Bentley claimed to be involved with classified projects in several government agencies due to his electrical engineering degree and graduate work in nuclear engineering. Bentley served as a private first class in the U.S. Army, where he was stationed at a Nike Ajax missile base just north of D.C., close to Olney, Maryland, as a radar operator. It was here he witnessed a UFO crash in May of 1958. Bentley first appeared on Greer's Disclosure Project in 2001, and while we don't have any affidavits like we did with Lovkin and Haught, I do find his claims worthy of investigation. And it is important to note, I have not been able to verify any of Harland's military, education, or contract records, so we have to analyze his story of a UFO crash and other astounding assertions on their own merit. In 1957 through 1959, Harland claimed to be stationed at a Nike Ajax missile facility just outside Olney, Maryland. This leaves us with two possible sites. Site W-92 of Gaithersburg, Maryland, nestled behind suburban complexes, and W-93 just north of Olney, which now serves as the Federal Support Center owned by FEMA. And quickly, what exactly is a Nike missile launch site? These facilities were utilized extensively during the Cold War, employing surface-to-air missile systems across the country and NATO to combat enemy bomber aircraft. The Project Nike, spearheaded by Bell Labs, equipped the U.S. Army to defend the American mainland and key sites from foreign aircraft raids. But back to Bentley. At 6 a.m. on May of 1958, Harland first heard a sound that was similar to a pulsating transformer. This reminds me closely to the sound Michael Herrera claimed to experience witnessing a human-made craft in 2009. Harland looked outside his window to a nearby civilian cornfield, roughly 2,000 yards away, to observe a disc-shaped object collide with the ground and immediately take off back into flight. Very unusual, as I have never heard of a UFO crash with the craft regaining flight capabilities. Harland immediately got dressed and ran to the hill to observe the debris left by the craft at a distance. One piece of metallic debris stuck out in particular, the size of a washing machine. This piece glowed white hot. Soon after, USAF personnel arrived utilizing long poles to harness the scattered pieces and place them on a lead-lined truck. This is something we see pop up in many crash retrieval stories. These personnel arrived in radiation protection suits. Harland had no idea where the material would be taken. The craft described by Bentley is certainly perplexing. It measured roughly 30 feet in diameter, was saucer-like, and had circular ball-like lights on the outer rim and a structure on top similar to a cake. This is reminiscent of many classic described saucer configurations. The lights on the craft cycled between orange, red, and white color and were described as pulsating. And one interesting thing I want to note here, Hartland states the saucer was, quote, wobbling before it impacted the Earth. This wobbling or gyration is something we often see in ufology, whether saucer or alternative shapes. One such recent example I covered is a 1950s Blue Book registered USO encounter in which a cigar-shaped object was seen hovering and wobbling above the ocean's surface. And one detail to note from the crash, when the craft took off again after colliding with the ground, the craft sheared off thick limbs of trees similar to the cutting of a sharp knife. This resembles closely the testimony of Corporal Jonathan Weygandt, who observed a UAP crash in Peru in 1997. Here, the craft sheared through local foliage and embedded itself within a chasm face. Quite shockingly, Harlan claims this is the boring part of his experience. The exciting part occurred the next evening while on duty. Near 10 to 11 p.m., a nearby Gaithersburg facility phoned the Nike Ajax facility, stating they had 12 to 15 UFOs hovering 50 to 100 feet off the ground, in varying shapes, some saucer-like. Harland asked the radio operator what these craft sounded like, only to hear the same pulsating sound when the operator stuck his headset out the van window. Bentley's facility was able to view the blips on the M33 radar sweep where the other facility sat, only for all signatures to take off in one sweep. For reference, the M33 is a 33.33 RPM radar detection device. For these objects to exit the center of the radar sweep as calculated from an analog computer, they would have had to be traveling at excess of 17,000 miles per hour. This value is astounding, but let's all remember the father of German rocketry and mentor to Wernher von Braun, Hermann Oberth, who gave a lecture on flying saucers in 1954, where he described recorded speeds of 19 kilometers per second, or 42,000 miles per hour. Harland claims the presiding general debriefed the men, stating the signatures were in fact helicopters performing Navy, Army, Air Force maneuver training exercises. We have no supporting evidence or testimony in May of 1958 to support Bentley's claims. In fact, I can only find a tiny snippet from Baltimore's Evening Sun newspaper on December 23, 1958, which makes a passing mention to the U.S. Air Force capturing at least two flying saucers. But we do have some very interesting contextual sightings and encounters from the same year in Maryland that are worth analyzing to see if we can find any connections. In October of 1958, less than 50 miles from Olney, Maryland, we can find a Blue Book documented case on the Loch Raven Reservoir. I bring this case up because it occurred 3.5 miles away from another Nike Ajax missile site, BA-03. At 10:30 p.m., Alvin Cohen and Philip Small were driving on Route 146, a mere 600 to 900 feet from the bridge at Loch Raven Reservoir. It is then they observed a 100-foot-long, egg-shaped object hover 100 to 150 feet over the bridge. When within 75 feet of the craft, their car stalled and the dash lights turned off. The two observed the UFO from outside the car for about 30 to 45 seconds before the craft emitted a beam of white light, making the men's faces grow hot. After hearing what they described as a dull explosion, the UFO rose vertically and disappeared within 5 to 10 seconds. The men were later treated for sunburns on their exposed skin. I highly recommend reading about this case in J. Allen Hynek's The UFO Experience, link in description. Another relevant case occurred on the 29th of September 1958 at the W-93 Ajax missile site, the same possible site I am guessing Harland may have been stationed. At 5:30 a.m., Private Jerome A. Scanlon was walking from his sentry post back to barracks when he heard a curious humming sound above him. Looking up, he sees a teardrop-shaped object 300 feet above him, coming in for a landing at roughly 30 miles an hour. The object moved over trees, sliced branches, and landed about 1.5 miles away. The luminous green skin on the object illuminated the nearby terrain. The craft then rose off the ground and out of sight. Scanlon and Riney Ferris, a sergeant who also saw the object, went to the site landing, only to observe broken branches and scorched earth. Comically, USAF had an official explanation for this case, and it was, in fact, repair trucks welding. Bentley also speaks about an incident that occurred in 1967 or 1968 while doing NASA classified contracting work at a location in California. This incident occurred while quote-unquote our astronauts were doing a loop around the moon and back. This leads me to conclude this alleged incident occurred on board Apollo 8, the first mission to orbit around the moon on October 11th, 1968, While the astronauts were en route to the moon, Harland overheard Houston control communication with the Apollo crew.
I heard the expression of a bogey coming in at 11 o'clock. Well, familiar with that particular term, I perked my ears and started listening a little bit and discovered that Houston and the astronauts were talking back and forth about a collision. And the astronauts asked for permission to do avoidance for a collision, and Houston finally granted that permission to do that. And after the comm length settled down a little bit, the astronaut said, "It's not necessary. They are now paralleling our course." And there was a discussion as to what was paralleling that course. It was another type of ship. There were portals there that they could see in. They could see beings of some sort. They did not describe these beings. They just took photographs. And after a while, a few thousand miles, and then they took off from the capsule that they were flying in and went away. They just said it was saucer-like.
A saucer-like craft.
Craft, yes.
That was paralleling their craft.
Actually paralleling their craft. And it was just far enough away they couldn't really distinguish. They saw movement. They saw somebody moving inside that ship. This is before the landing, yes. It was probably in 68, 67 maybe, somewhere in that time frame. All they said was, there they go, and they went out of sight almost immediately from their conversation. It was unedited because of where I was.
Harland claimed there was solely a singular gentleman with him when he overheard this transmission who told Bentley, quote, "You did not hear anything," end quote. Bentley said the reaction of Houston control astronauts were stoic, like this was no big thing. And there's really not much to go off here, but you know me. We hear Apollo 8 possible NHI encounter, we investigate. In Stephen Greer's UFO Whistleblower and Witness List, we find a redacted entry of an individual in government. His bio reads, quote, "Saw the official uncut version of the NASA film footage depicting six UFOs descending onto the moon's surface taken by astronaut Frank Borman during Apollo 8 in 1968. Borman had famously what the media ran with as a UFO sighting on board NASA Gemini 8 in December of 1965.
Gemini 7 here, Houston, are you ready?
Loud and clear. 7, go ahead.
Come bogey at 10 o'clock high.
This is Houston. Say again, 7.
So we have a bogey at 10 o'clock high.
Roger.
Gemini Control here again. The reference in that conversation was bogey. It was Borman who reported sighting the bogey. This is Gemini Control in Houston at 4.
It is worth noting Borman himself stated the quote-unquote bogey of this incident was just the rocket's own booster. But an alleged film showing six UFOs descending onto the moon's surface is quite the allegation, and absolutely warrants investigation. Here we see this witness is tagged as number 10179. On Greer's Disclosure Project archives, we can actually find files and emails with this witness. Greer and this source first planned to meet in April of 2009. The source was traveling from France and would be accompanied by a high-profile French astronaut. The two planned to connect via phone in late February. We can see Greer's first note from February 24th, 2009, with this witness labeled AB. "Curse you, Greer, for this handwriting." I can make out the two discussing hoaxes and truth, redacted names of trustworthy and untrustworthy individuals, and I personally cannot decipher if Borman is mentioned within this transcript. NASA is only brought up by AB, questioning if the institution is trustworthy, to which Greer states most NASA employees know nothing. On the 28th of February 2009, the source forwarded Greer a L'Express article from France, pointing to a section titled "A Pilot from NASA." The article discusses the White House planning to appoint the next director of NASA. It then goes on to talk about who's in the running and Charles Colonel, associate administrator under Clinton, finally referencing Bolden, who has 4 space shuttle flights under his belt. Were these the NASA pilots, especially Bolden, the two referenced in the handwritten notes we saw with redacted names? On early March 2009, we can see an email chain from Stephen Greer regarding transmission of briefing documents toward the French President Nicolas Sarkozy, And here we see it. Greer burned his source. One A. Baudier is listed as the man bringing the documents to the French president. Using the context of these emails, I was able to even find out this source. One Alain Baudier, who around this time of these emails was appointed president of the French National Aeronautical and Astronautical Association Unidentified Aerospace Phenomena Division, the 3AFPAN. And as of this writing of this video, I have actually reached out to Baudier, hoping to learn more about this Apollo 8 alleged film. Because where I stand, I can find zero references or lines of research to this alleged NHI incident or NHI film on Apollo 8. A lot of tangents from Mr. Harlan Bentley here, but I think these claims parallel other investigations of UAP at this time, and they are fascinating. Next, I want to cover former U.S. Senator Barry Goldwater, who attempted to peek behind the veil of UFO secrecy. Goldwater served as a major general in the USAF Reserve, senator of Arizona from 53 to 65 and 69 to 87, and even ran as Republican nominee for president in 1964. In 1975, Goldwater made a powerful statement during an interview about UFO secrecy to the American public.
I think the government does know. I can't back that up, but I think that Wright-Patterson Field, if you could get into certain places, you'd find out what the Air Force and the government knows about UFOs. Reportedly, a spaceship landed. It was all hushed up, quieted, and nobody ever, I've never heard about much of it. I called Curtis LeMay and I said, General, I know we have a room at Wright-Patterson where you put all this secret stuff. Can I go in there? I've never heard him get mad, but he got madder than hell at me, cussed me out, said, don't ever ask me that question again.
Before we get into these claims, I'd like to analyze a couple excerpts from letters written by Goldwater to UFO researchers regarding Wright-Patterson Air Force Base compiled by one of my inspirations, Leonard Stringfield. If you all remember back, I first referenced Stringfield in my Kingman crash video. Since then, his status reports on crash retrievals has become a Bible of sorts for me. In a letter to Stringfield from December 3, 1974, Goldwater wrote he had been agnostic towards UFOs throughout his life. With the amount of stars in our galaxy, he reckoned life may very well exist outside of our planet. He states, quote, I made an effort to get into the room at Wright-Patterson Field where the information was stored, and I was denied this request. Years later, Goldwater was still interested in the quote-unquote Blue Room. Writing to UFO researcher Lee Graham on October 19, 1981, stating, quote, I don't know of anyone who has access to the Blue Room, nor am I aware of its contents, and I am not aware of anything having been relocated. This thing has gotten so highly classified, even though I will admit there is a lot of it that has been released, it is just impossible to get anything on it, end quote. Goldwater also wrote to an unknown UFO researcher, S.A., not sure who this is, on March 28, 1975. Here, Goldwater stated for a long time he had been interested in UFOs without a strong belief. 10 or 12 years before, so the early 1960s, maybe 1963, and remember that date, quote, I made an effort to find out what was in the building at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where the information is stored that has been collected by the Air Force. And I was understandably denied this request. It is still classified above top secret, end quote. The storage of UFOs, materials, or bodies at Wright-Patt should not come as a shock. I will plan to do a full video on this famous site as I bring it up pretty much every other video, but I will leave you with this April 27th, 1953 Air Force Office of Special Investigations document regarding an interview of Master Sergeant Ralph Brown from Captain Plandowski. Brown relayed a message he had been with a redacted gentleman who informed him that Wright-Patt had in its possession a total of 3 flying saucers, 1 damaged and 2 functional. The base also had the bodies of the pilots on board. I include this document because even with the suppression of the Roswell event in 1947 to 1978, rumors of NHI craft and bodies surrounding Wright-Patt Air Force Base were nothing new around this time. And it's interesting to see Goldwater plainly tell that General Curtis LeMay grew angry with him and told him to stop the pursuit of the Blue Room. Yes, the same LeMay who said after World War II that USAF should be allowed to develop unhindered with no restrictions, limitations, or hindrance to their air supremacy.
The next war will be fought out fast. It'll be a war of rockets, radar, television-guided missiles, and atomic power. Before the next war, the Air Force must be allowed to develop unhindered, unchained. There must be no ceilings, no boundaries, no limitations to our air development.
And worthy to note, too, is the 1999 July MUFON UFO Journal issue, in which LeMay's name is tied to a fascinating UFO encounter. In this incident, LeMay was present at a close encounter between a F-89J Scorpion and a 30-foot object with four blue-white lights at James Connolly Air Force Base. After a near collision, the object darted off vertically to disappear at 90,000 feet. In this enigmatic blue room, in a FOIA request from Brian Parks in 1991, USAF Colonel Eddie L. Anderson responded by saying materials relating to a blue room, in this case, a film, was destroyed on the 9th of September 1965, which is, of course, curiously around the time of Senator Goldwater's request. And now we get to a whistleblower who may have in fact guarded the enigmatic blue room I just spoke of. I want to add, we cannot verify this whistleblower's claims, let alone his identity, but I find this story so interesting, especially in conjunction with Goldwater, I have to give it a mention. In Leonard Stringfield's UFO Crash Retrieval Status Report 5, we can find a case titled Marine Guards, a Disc-Shaped Vehicle, 1963. This case discusses how UFO researcher Michael Johnstone arranged to connect Stringfield with a former Marine who claimed in 1963 he stood guard at an undisclosed military base which housed a disc-shaped vehicle. Fast forward to the 2000s, where researcher and incredible CAD artist Michael Schratt was allowed to access the late Stringfield's personal archives locked away in MUFON, Cincinnati. Within these journals, Schratt finally uncovered the entire story of this enigmatic RB. Michael found in Stringfield's notes letters between the researcher and Michael B. Johnstone discussing RB. This RB served in the Marines from 1960 to 66 as a weapons tech and was a corporal who possessed an interim top secret security clearance. Quote, for 2 weeks in December of 1963, he was the guard or one of the guards in charge of security for a large metal building on an undisclosed military base. The building housed a craft of a type unknown to him, end quote. And I do want to mention, we do see this witness, RB, under Stephen Greer's witness list as a redacted name, numbered 10138. Unfortunately, like the Harland case and the French astronauts, we don't have any documents leading us down a rabbit hole to discover his identity. To get to this location, RB had boarded a windowless plane and was flown 3 hours from Cherry Point, North Carolina Marine Corps Air Station to a location he would not reveal. One possible location within this range is, of course, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. The vehicle was disc-shaped, 40 feet long, totally symmetrical, and featured an ovoid cross-section. It appeared silverish with a polished aluminum appearance. Similar to many craft descriptions, quote, the craft was totally seamless, except for a hatch-like seam on the lower part of the craft, which was so well fitted, you could not get a razor blade in the crack. The craft featured no landing gear, fins, propulsion, etc. What looked to RB as windows lined the edge of the craft, spaced 1 foot apart from each other, and with the appearance of smoked glass. From RB's own words, quote, you couldn't see in them, even if you got right up close to them, end quote. The craft was almost hamburger-shaped. This UFO sat elevated 5 feet off the ground, surrounded by scaffolding. Joined by 3 to 4 other guards, RB observed a technical crew working on the craft attempting to gain entry. He observed drilling and cutting with torches near the hatch, all to no avail. RB stated, quote, metal got hot under the torch, but when it cooled, you could wipe off the soot. and the surface remained clean and undamaged, end quote. RB even claims to have observed attempts to cut into the craft via high-powered laser, powered by two semi-sized trailer generator vans. The beams completely deflected off the craft, damaging the ceiling. During this time, RB observed civilian scientists make specific mentions about aliens, leading him to realize this craft was not made by humans. Within the facility, strict rules were implemented. Color-coded security badges corresponded with color-coded areas. Engineers and scientists had access to only their allocated parts of a craft. However, a red badge provided total access to the vehicle. A white tape circle surrounded the craft, which not even USAF generals could cross. RB stated he even stopped the Secretary of the Navy from crossing this line. During his guard duty, RB snapped an image of the craft using a small German pocket camera. The image was purported to be lost in a flood around 83. And one day, reporting for duty, RB observed the craft being prepped for transport, sitting on a flatbed trailer. He was told it was being shuttled from base to base for quote-unquote security reasons. The Marine made no assertions to witnessing bodies, however, he had heard second-hand stories of retrievals recovering bodies of beings 39 inches tall, with no thumbs, that were stored in an underground base in a western state. When exiting the Marines, RB was forced to sign a security oath that carried with it a 10-year prison sentence and $10,000 fine for violation. In 2015, Michael Schratt was able to interview Michael Johnstone and was able to gather some additional pieces of this story I have used here in this video. Huge thank you for all of his time and effort on this case. What's up, guys? Thank you so much for watching, and I hope you enjoyed our second entry investigating UFO whistleblowers. As I said in the first video, we will be tackling all types of whistleblowers, whether it's people with solid affidavits like Haught and Lovekin, or a little more enigmatic claims without much to back them up, like Hartland Bentley here. Regardless of the fact, I find Hartland's claims super interesting, especially about the Ajax missile crash and how the UFO he saw struck the ground and then departed back into flight. As far as his Apollo 8 claims, I am not quite sure what to make of those. As we saw in the video, there's a pretty deep rabbit hole of Stephen Greer connected to an alleged Apollo 8 film depicting UFOs descending onto the moon's surface. And while this is unrelated to Hartland Bentley's claims, if I can do some investigation there and find out there's some real meat to this case, that could lend some credence to the fact the Apollo 8 crew encountered some sort of craft on their way to the moon. As far as Barry Goldwater and the Blue Room, I wanted to include that just to kind of show you guys, if you haven't heard about him, some really powerful statements made by some pretty important people in U.S. American history, especially how Goldwater knocks on the door of Wright-Patt and is denied access to the quote-unquote Blue Room. One possible explanation to that Blue Room may be RB. And I hope you guys enjoyed that story, because as of right now, that's one of the most fascinating kind of military encounters I can cover and I can think of. Behind the scenes, I'm doing some more investigation with that. I might have a lead to where I can know this man's name. If that's the case, I'd like to try and get in contact with him. But seeing as he was in his late 40s in the 1986 interview he did with Michael B. Johnstone, time is running out, and I hope he's still alive. And I hope he might want to speak. I might reach out to Schratt and try and get some help on that case, because I just find that so interesting, especially that craft description propped up on scaffolding, the white line, the different color-coded badges. And with that craft, even though the shape and the windows is a bit anomalous in terms of what we hear as described with classic saucers, cigars, and so forth, I find the super strong material and the seam similar to Machu Picchu, you can't even put a paper between. I find that so fascinating. That case is really of interest to me. I'm so happy I found that. And I do think it's interesting that witness is listed in Greer's witness list. Has he spoken to Greer? I don't know. All I know is this RB has never gone public with his story, nor tried to make any sensationalized claims or make a dime from it. I think one quote from Michael Schratt is, RB's wife didn't believe the story until she actually saw the photograph before it was lost. And of course, with photographic evidence that somehow pops up and is lost, that's always a red flag. However, in this case, I will give it a pass until I know more. But I hope you guys enjoyed this. If there's any specific whistleblowers you want to see in future entries, just let me know. I have a long list, some credible, some not, some fantastical claims, some not, that I want to cover, and I won't be covering kind of the big hitters like Bob Lazar. They warrant their own video, and even some more enigmatic guys that I can put off like an hour or two of content on, such as microbiologist Dan Barish. If you're watching now, that's probably going to be a video I make in the future. That and Project Aquarius is extremely interesting. But if there's any other whistleblowers you guys want to see covered, or crash retrieval cases, please let me know. In terms of crash retrievals, my friends, I got the Mecca right here. Magic Eyes Only, Ryan S. Wood. He and I recently connected on the phone. I spoke to him. He's a brilliant man, brilliant book. I fully recommend this piece if you're interested in crash retrievals. This is kind of like my handbook besides Leonard Stringfield's Crash Retrieval Reports 1-7. When I'm investigating a crash, you know what I do? I'll pop up this book. I'm not sponsored, by the way. This is just such a good book. But please, guys, remember to like and subscribe. I got a Patreon, link in description. If you think the channel is worth anything, donate what you can afford and what you think the channel's worth. I'm not going to gatekeep any of my content, so you know I don't have any podcast or extra good videos behind the scenes that you can't get if you're not paying. I appreciate every single one of you being here, and I will catch you guys on the next show. Thank you so much.